Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast that spotlights women in Baltimore. In a recent Baltimore Sun story, Aaron Cox and Michael Dresser reported that 41% of Maryland residents said the escalating opioid epidemic has directly affected them or someone they know over the past 5 years. That number comes from a Gonzales poll, and among Baltimore City residents, the percentage affected was even higher, at 68%. One of the nonprofits attempting to halt this epidemic, along with addressing other mental health and addiction issues, is Behavioral Health System Baltimore, and at the head is Kathy Westcote. Kathy, the organization's president, got her start in Baltimore as a dietitian, and she talked about what prompted her to interrogate and address the larger factors that contribute to public health. Behavioral Health System Baltimore acts as the city's behavioral health authority, and Kathy joined the organization in 2015, after serving as president of Healthcare Access Maryland. We talked about how Kathy's upbringing has informed her work, preparing for the possible repeal of the Affordable Care Act, and fighting the stigma around addiction and mental illness. Here's our conversation. Kathy, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me today.
First off, what is behavioral health?
Behavioral health is really an indication of somebody's well-being, mental well-being. So at Behavioral Health System Baltimore, we focus on individuals' behavioral health by ensuring that they have access to mental health treatment as well as substance use disorder treatment.
Yeah, can you tell me a little bit more about Behavioral Health System Baltimore?
Yeah, so we are the product of two entities that merged together about 3 years ago, Baltimore Mental Health Systems and Baltimore Substance Abuse Systems. A lot of the funding at the state and federal level were coming together, so it only made sense for these two agencies to come together as well. So we merged about 3 years ago. Our name is Behavioral Health System Baltimore. We have about 85 employees, and we're located on 1 North Charles Street, but essentially we oversee a large system of care in Baltimore City and make sure that individuals have access to mental health and drug treatment services.
So it is a focus on Baltimore City?
Yes. Yeah, so it's a Baltimore City specific nonprofit. All of our funding is allocated to us just to provide services in the city, in the city boundaries.
What were some of the benefits or drawbacks that came from that merger? I know that was before you were there, but can you speak to that at all?
Yeah, well, one major issue right now is, a few years ago and even currently is, you know, we see behavioral health as being very, very much linked. So individuals would try to access mental health treatment, but they might have had a substance abuse issue. So the mental health provider would say, you know what, why don't you get that substance use disorder corrected first before you can access mental health treatment or vice versa. Oftentimes, untreated mental health is substance use disorders result from untreated mental health issues where people will tend to self-medicate by using either prescription drugs or illicit drugs to cover up some of their emotions that they're feeling. So it was very important for the agencies to merge together to be able to treat people holistically, but also we were following what was going on in the state and nationally in terms of the funding is now going to be a bit more integrated than it was before, so we can more holistically work with people.
And is there less funding? Is that what that means?
No, there's not actually. Actually, the funding had stayed whole, actually, from both sides. But we're just trying to do a better job of integrating the services so people don't have to go to four different places to address their mental health needs. So right now, the funding has been intact. I don't know. And that was really a result of the Affordable Care Act expanding so exponentially over the past few years. We don't know what the future holds with the new administration. There are, I'm sure you've heard lots of talk about repealing the Affordable Care Act. So if that happens, there will be significant implications to those who are accessing or those who are in need of mental health treatment.
So in a practical sense, can you describe more what Behavioral Health System Baltimore does? Are you allocating funding? Are you directly giving people these services? Or can you tell me more about that?
Sure. We are not a direct service provider. However, we work with a wide network of providers. So up until this year, and I'll explain in a few minutes how that's changed, but we have provided direct grants to multiple providers across the city for mental health and substance use services. And up until July 1st of this year, a lot of that funding is now going to be reimbursed by Medicaid. So those providers will now have to bill Medicaid instead of receiving grants from our agency. But so that's really one, you know, one piece of what we do. We have about a $70 million budget now. But we also do, we also look at data from data that is available to us so it can help inform policy decisions. We've also elevated policy and advocacy within our organization. So just this morning, we had a wonderful policy forum with our state and federal partners to talk about, you know, this new legislative season and what could potentially be coming down for at the federal level with the repeal of the Affordable Care Act and what that might mean at the local level. So we are more than a funder. We're really a systems partner where we help providers. We help them understand policy decisions that have been made at the federal and state level. We help with any new regulations that might be coming into place. So we're real partners with the providers in the community and do way more than provide grant funds. We try to be a system, work within the system.
So you've been in this position a little more than a year now.
Yeah.
What were you doing before?
So I was with another nonprofit called Healthcare Access Maryland for about 17 years. And that organization really focused on enrolling people into eligible healthcare programs and services. So we were awarded the largest grant in the state of Maryland when the Affordable Care Act was passed to help enroll individuals who qualified for Medicaid as well as those that qualified for health insurance programs on the exchange. So, you know, it was a really great evolution. Being there for so long, for 17 years, we were really able to kind of stay relevant and watch how healthcare reform was shaping up in the state. When I first started, the Medicaid program only provided healthcare services to children, pregnant women and children. So over the time that I was there, I was able to see more and more populations being added into the eligibility criteria for Medicaid. So it was really an exciting time. And I had been there for 17 years and I thought that it was, you know, it was time for a change. So that's why I'm here now at Behavioral Health System Baltimore.
How did you first get involved in this type of work?
Well, it's an interesting question. So I worked at Mercy Medical Center. I was a registered dietitian. I went to college to be a dietitian, and I was a dietitian working at Mercy, and I, you know, would be talking to inner city patients about their diets, and then I came across so many people that had such larger issues, social issues, people that did not have adequate housing, people that didn't have even a refrigerator, or people who had real challenges accessing just food or transportation. So I became very, very interested in sort of the social justice issues that surrounded health. So, you know, being a dietitian, it was a good stepping stone, but it was too linear for me. I needed to do something that was much broader. So we happen to live in a city that has the greatest public health program really in the world, Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. So I applied to go there, and I did go, and I got my master in public health. And that really opened up my eyes to, you know, looking at policy in a very different way and gave me an opportunity to look at things from a much, much broader perspective. So that's really what launched my interest in public health and launched my interest in really working with the underserved. That has always been a great passion for me. I fundamentally believe that, you know, healthcare is a right. It's not a privilege. I continue to be frustrated with how healthcare is organized here in the United States. So many other industrialized countries have access to good quality, affordable health care for their citizens. And, we're not there yet. I think the Affordable Care Act really made tremendous and enormous strides. But the thought of that potentially going away is really, really frightening and I think fundamentally wrong.
In your early work as a dietitian, was that a bit of a wake-up call for you. Did you have, you know, any idea before you started working with some of these underserved people that health and policy were so connected in that way?
I did not. I mean, it wasn't until I, you know, was working, and I also worked for the Women, Infants, and Children's Program at the University of Maryland, where I was in regular contact with low-income women and children. It really wasn't until I was able to spend time on the ground really working and really listening to people and hearing about what their challenges were. I wasn't really able to link it up until I was directly involved. And, you know, I did have lots of classwork that helped prepare me, but nothing really prepares you in the way that sitting down with individuals and hearing about their lives and hearing about their struggles. So it was an eye-opener for me coming from, I was, you know, from the Pittsburgh area. So I moved here and I've, you know, been in Baltimore City for about 24, 25 years. And I've really, really enjoyed working with the underserved and with Baltimore City residents.
What brought you to Baltimore initially?
So my husband, he was from the Annapolis area, and we were, you know, doing the long distance dating and commuting. So we got married in 94, and then I moved to Baltimore and at that time.
I am always curious about kind of credibility when I do speak to people who are dealing with potentially underserved populations and they haven't necessarily had the same life experiences. Mm-hmm. Have you ever run into issues of people saying, yeah, I get it, but, you know, why aren't you understanding that I can't afford to buy these foods or things like that? I mean, obviously, this is your expertise and you do understand, but is there ever a disconnect with, you know, you're not living my life, how am I to believe this?
Yeah, I think, well, it's interesting. I think we often make assumptions about people and where they came from. And so, you know, I grew up in a outside of Pittsburgh in a steel town. And there were, you know, there was lots of, you know, unemployment. My dad was a, you know, blue collar worker on the railroad. I remember him getting laid off a few times. And my mother was, you know, a stay at home mom. And, you know, although I think my life experience is different than what many of individuals in inner city Baltimore are facing, but I can relate on some levels to some of the struggles, you know, personally that some folks have, you know, have faced. But yeah, I do think that it's important for, you know, to get the word out through messengers who have lived experience. So at Behavioral Health System Baltimore, for instance, we hire a lot of peer support, peer navigators who work with clients to help, you know, it's easier for them who have lived experience to help get somebody into drug treatment than it might be for me talking to somebody about that experience.
Was that urge to give back instilled in you as a child in Pittsburgh?
What that's very interesting. So I, you know, again, I grew up in a, you know, blue collar family in a household where we always did try to give back to the community. And so I would say yes, from an early age that I learned that it was very important to give back and to help others and try to lift others up when there are problems and troubles.
Did you always think you would be involved in health?
No, in fact, I went to when I graduated from high school. And I should mention too that you know, my family did not have, you know, very high aspirations for me. I grew up in an Italian household, and Italian girls got married right out of high school, and they had husbands that took care of them. So the plan for me was, you know, to go to secretarial school and hopefully meet somebody and get married, like, you know, like my sister did, who has since, you know, done other wonderful things with her life. So, but I knew, like, that is not what I wanted for myself. I had much grander plans in mind. So I went to Penn State and had a really terrific and wonderful experience. I financed the entire education myself through student loans and working several jobs to get myself through. So I think through that, I, you know, gained a lot of tenacity and really was able to, you know, I had to do things the hard way. Things weren't very, very easy for me. So it wasn't, you know, a lot of my friends had, you know, a lot of advantages by, you know, their college being paid for them. But it was, you know, I was the first in my family, the youngest of four. So I was the first in my family with an 8-year span between myself and my sister. I was the first in my family to actually go to college and graduate.
And how was that received in your family?
You know what? It was, you know, I was looked at as, you know, wow, she's really going to get out of here and do something great with her life. And so they were all very supportive. And since my two older sisters, they both went on, got their bachelor's degree, both got their master's degree. So they later were able to make those same accomplishments. But I just knew early on that I did not want to stay where I was in this sort of, I don't want to say dilapidated steel town, but there wasn't much going on there. There wasn't a lot of energy. There wasn't a lot of, I just wasn't interested in staying there. I knew I wanted to get out, and I knew that I wanted to have an impact on people's lives. So I always knew that. I just didn't know in what way I wanted to have impact. Because for me, at the end of the day, it's really important for me to feel like I have given back or that I've contributed. I hear of some, you know, other people's jobs where they're, you know, maybe in sales or doing something. I just could never have a job like that. Like, I have to feel good at the end of the day. And I'm not saying salespeople don't have good jobs. I'm just saying I have to do something that's really meaningful and human every day.
Where does that sense of ambition come from? And when you knew early on that you wanted to get out and do something, do you remember like how you came to that realization or people that you were looking to as inspiration or anything like that?
Yeah, so it's interesting, and I've thought about that because I've, you know, gotten the question from some of my siblings, like, why, you know, kind of what made you different in that way. But I would say I always knew from an early age that I wanted to go out there and be ambitious and do something remarkable. And I will tell you, I didn't have, you know, a lot of the odds were against me. I was, you know, an average student. I wasn't a standout student. I just kind of got by, if you will. But I will say that I've always, I just always had the urge and the drive. So I think fundamentally having that ingredient was what was able to help me get over the obstacles of, you know, my parents not wanting me to go to college and being able to, you know, get to college, but then really prove myself academically. And so there was just something I feel like that was always inside of me, and I'm not exactly sure where it came from.
How did you find the transition to Baltimore to be?
It was a little bit difficult, It was just, you know, moving to a brand new state. I was newly married, started a new job. So it was a lot of transition at one time. But I, you know, quickly grew to love Baltimore, and I remained very committed to Baltimore and Baltimore City. I made a lot of great friends at my first job at Mercy Medical Center, many of whom I'm still, you know, in touch with. And I really liked it. We moved to Fells Point, lived there. I moved into the bachelor pad. And after a couple years, we realized that might not be a good place to raise a family. So we moved to Catonsville, and we have been there for a little over 20 years now.
So to transition back into your current job, what are the needs you're trying to address? What are the mental health and addiction needs that Baltimoreans are facing?
Well, Baltimore is not unlike many other cities who are really struggling with a major heroin epidemic. The rates of opioid use in the city are staggering. In the state of Maryland, I just heard a talk this morning, you know, there over 1,000 people have died from overdose just this year, or, you know, last year through October. And if you think about that, it's, you know, three or four jumbo jets that crashed in the state of Maryland and everybody died. I mean, if that really happened, there would be all kinds of momentum around trying to, you know, address this issue and figure out what happened. So we have a major heroin crisis. We have lots of people who are in need of mental health treatment, but they don't know how to access healthcare, or they don't know how to access treatment. And as I mentioned previously, some people, you know, they'll drink alcohol or use other drugs to help self-medicate some of those difficult emotions like depression and anxiety. So we're doing several things at Behavioral Health System Baltimore to, you know, address the heroin epidemic. We're also, we have a crisis information and referral line that operates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to help individuals who are in need of, you know, either crisis services or in need of mental health and drug treatment, who can call that number. And that number is 410-433-5175 if they are in need of treatment. So we are trying to help people access treatment, working on the heroin epidemic. And we are also working with multiple providers and stakeholders in the city to begin planning for our advocacy and policy priorities moving forward with the new administration coming in, not only locally, but at the federal level.
I'm curious about your experience of the awareness of the opioid epidemic in the larger population, because there's obviously the criticism that this has been going on for years and years, yes. And now we're just paying attention to it because it's reaching the suburbs or reaching white populations. Yeah. You have also only been working directly with this, I guess, for a year. So I don't know if more of that, you know, I don't know if that hurdle was jumped over before you started working at Behavioral Health System Baltimore. But I'm curious what the perception is like in the greater population and to what extent that informs your work.
Yeah. So the opioid crisis has, well underway before I got to Behavioral System Baltimore, but it really did not begin to capture the attention of people, you know, legislators, lawmakers, until, you know, unfortunately it hit white suburbia, where young white people were dying, housewives were, you know, found using heroin. So unfortunately, you know, we've had this epidemic for many, many years, not quite at this level. But so I do think that there is greater awareness. However, I think we have a lot more, I think we've got a long way to go. There is still, I think, so much stigma associated with individuals who are in need of drug treatment. People can be very judgmental to individuals who need treatment. I know here in the city, one common misbelief is that, you know, we have several drug treatment programs that will offer medication to help curb the heroin use, which is methadone and buprenorphine. So several families in the city who have loved ones with addiction issues, they feel that, you know, they're just exchanging one drug for another, instead of using heroin, they're using buprenorphine or methadone. And so we have to get through to people that it is not the same. These are clinically, you know, proven treatments that are available to help people move away from their heroin abuse. But I believe we have a long way to go with awareness. Unfortunately, heroin is not something that's sexy to talk about, but people hold a lot of preconceived notions about people who have drug addiction issues, such as, you know, it being a moral failing, or they're not strong enough, or they don't, you know, something must have, you know, really went wrong in their lives for them to go to drugs. But that, you know, it is a brain disorder. It is a bona fide scientific clinical disorder. So we have to recognize it equally as we would, you know, hypertension or diabetes. People need to see addiction in the same light as they see any other chronic disease.
Seeing the same kind of stigmas persist with mental illness. I mean, I know we talked about how is obviously interconnected with many addiction issues, but if someone is just depressed, say, are you also seeing the same kind of stigma come up with mental health treatment?
Absolutely. And I didn't mean to just, you know, point out the drug addiction. It's across the board. It is with mental health, drug use. That's why it's easier to say behavioral health, because it's kind of all encompassing. But there's a tremendous amount of stigma around individuals needing to access mental health. And here in the city, I will say, you know, several churches feel like you should just talk to your minister and, you know, and work through God to help those, to help your mental illness or to help your drug addiction. But 1 in 5 Americans has a mental health disorder. So if you, you know, look at that in the city, that's, you know, it's a fairly high number of people who, we believe only about half of the people in the city who actually need mental health treatment actually receive it. And we believe a large portion of people don't access it because of stigma, because of they're embarrassed, fearful of what family members might say, or just their people thinking that they're weak, or, you know, they should just figure it out.
What kinds of stigma or misconceptions do you run into about your job and about the work that Behavioral Health System Baltimore does?
That's an interesting question. I will say most of the agencies in the city that we work with are, you know, we're pretty much in alignment with the work that we're trying to accomplish. We work very closely with the health department. We work very closely with the police department. But so in the city, it's, I would say, you know, pretty friendly. I think most people are in favor of what it is that we are trying to accomplish. But I can't say everybody holds that view. Generally, you know, we're working with vulnerable populations who might not have access to health insurance or other resources. So sometimes there is conflict, and it goes back to, you know, healthcare is a right, not a privilege. And again, I'm just going to go back to, I feel that anybody, regardless of socioeconomic status or race or income levels, you should be able to have access to high quality healthcare, regardless of who you are.
So what are the greatest challenges of meeting the treatment needs of people in Baltimore?
The greatest needs are, I would say, making sure that, I would say the greatest challenge is I think, breaking through this stigma. I think there's a lot of people out there who are in need of services that are simply not getting them for whatever reason. I think that's the biggest challenge. So we have to do a good job of raising awareness and breaking down those walls and breaking down those barriers and educating people about mental illness and drug addiction and helping put them on the same level playing field with some of these other chronic health conditions, and so we can all see them in the same way. I think we're many, many years away from that. That's a big challenge. Right now, this is, you know, just making sure that there is appropriate levels of treatment available for people across the city, and making sure that there's adequate space to be able to treat everybody. Because if everybody came to us who was in need right now, we would not have the capacity.
In your job, does it seem to be more of an issue of knowing what works, knowing what's effective, and not having the resources for it, like you're saying, like not having the space for everyone? Or is it even a challenge to know the most effective way to treat certain types of addictions, certain types of mental illness?
Okay, I think I know what you're saying. So there are challenges with, you know, there are things that absolutely work. And, you know, there are strategies that we think could be very, very beneficial. For instance, I'm just going to use this as an example. But, you know, we think that people who are incarcerated should have access to drug treatment while they're incarcerated. Instead, that option is not really available for many, many people who are incarcerated. And this kind of gets back to your earlier question. You know, some people don't feel bad for those individuals who are incarcerated. Well, you know, forget them. They don't need treatment behind the walls. And, you know, they've done lots of bad things. Why should we care about them? But we should care about them, because our inability to effectively give them drug treatment generally winds up with, you know, them being released from prison or jail and them doing the exact same thing that they did before that landed them in jail in the first place. So we have some solutions. So it's sometimes frustrating that, you know, yes, we do think that having drug treatment behind the walls would reduce recidivism rates. We do think that it would decrease crime. We do think that it would increase, you know, employment and all these things. However, we don't have the resources at this time to actually make that happen. So we have ideas about some solutions that would work, but we're unable to actually execute them. You know, we're working on strategies, we're working on ways, but it's always, you know, funding and budget issues. And, you know, they're not a popular group. So we don't have a lot of people handing us a bunch of money to care for the incarcerated. But there's great social reward, if you will, if you are providing the service for individuals who are struggling with drug treatment behind the walls. So I think that answers one part of your question. But we do know that there are, you know, scientifically proven ways to help people, and that is medication-assisted treatment through buprenorphine and also through methadone. They're scientifically proven. So we just would like to get more people who are accessing drug treatment in the first place to have access to those drugs, and also combine, have adequate counseling available too, because, you know, a drug by itself generally is much more helpful to have the counseling component along with it, so you can start exploring why you landed in this place in the first place.
What's the most frustrating part of your job?
Wow. The most frustrating part of the job, I would say, like right now, just currently, just not really knowing what the future holds for behavioral health if, again, I mentioned this earlier, but if the Affordable Care Act is repealed, we are going to be in a place where we're really limiting benefits to a lot of people here in the city and across the state. And that worries me a lot. So I would say just changes in, you know, federal policy and state policy and things that we really can't predict are, you know, are very, very challenging. But one, you know, I guess something that we've been dealing with more over the past year is the true integration of mental and substance use disorder. We've got a long way to go with that. People, providers are still thinking very much in silos. Well, I'm going to treat the mental health and, you know, you have to go somewhere else for the substance use. Like, we really need to pull those things together so we can treat people holistically. And again, we still have a long way to go with that.
Have you made any changes yet since Donald Trump's election? Are you gearing up for anything, or is it totally unexpected? And
we have no idea. The only thing that I do know could potentially happen, you know, and this is just reading the national news networks, but right now, if you know, one of the ideas is to give each state X amount of dollars and a block grant for to manage its Medicaid program. So what that means is, you know, lots of people would likely, you know, lose their benefits. So I'm kind of expecting that that will happen. I just don't know when or what it will look like or how severe it will be. But it's just very challenging. You know, I feel like we've come so far from a public health standpoint, and the Obama administration really treated people, really realized that it wasn't acceptable to have 47 million uninsured Americans. It, you know, it's not acceptable. And how we can have shifted in this country in such a different way is just it's very concerning.
Going back to your earlier point, do you ever find it challenging? Do you have to convince people that healthcare is a right and not a privilege?
Yes. Yeah. Really? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, some people just think, well, you know what, you're on your own. It's if you don't have a good job that can pay benefits, then that's your fault. And, you know, there's a lot of people that actually think this way. I generally don't work with many of them, but there's still, I think, widely held belief that, you know, probably close to half of the country believes that we should not have to take care of one another. So I think it's just fundamental differences in beliefs and how we treat other people. And I think what people need to realize is that our world and our country would be so much more successful if we all work together and we're able to take care of each other.
I think it's pretty commonly understood that in many senses there are two Baltimores, and you can live in Harbor East and maybe have no idea to a certain extent what is going on in Sandtown, for example. I've had a lot of guests tell me that belief, that there can kind of be these two worlds. And I'm curious if you ever encounter that in your work. Are people in Baltimore to any extent oblivious to any of these things that are going on, or are they touching everyone?
I think so. I mean, I think there are a fair amount of people that are oblivious to not what's going on in the city necessarily, because that's all over the news all the time, but what the fundamental issues are and what the causes are. Not, you know, I don't have all the answers to that, but, you know, really a lot of, you know, many people who might be in the business world or, you know, working in, you know, law firms, or, you know, they just don't have the access to sort of the everyday knowledge of you know, of what's going on. And because I'm in the public health world and, you know, doing what I do, I'm able to see it every day. So, you know, I've wondered to myself, you know, had I continued on that business path that I originally set out to do when I went to Penn State, how sort of socially responsible would I don't know. Like, I've just wondered if I just think their context is, sometimes people's contexts are just very, very different, where they don't have to interface with it every day. So if you're not interfacing it or living it or dealing with issues specifically related to the problems in the city, you might not really know what's going on.
Did you start out in business at Penn State?
That was my initial major. So, you know, I had to pick something. I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I picked business and I took economics. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is not going to work for me. I know it. So then I switched to health.
Okay. In your first 13 months on the job, I guess, what have been some of the biggest surprises and the biggest learning curves?
there were several challenges when I came into the organization, because there were, there were two agencies that came together. So there wasn't, admittedly, there wasn't a lot of synergy, I think, within the organization with people working together. Still, there were those silos. Well, I work on mental health and I work on substance use. So I think over the past year, we've made some tremendous strides in working together and try to overlap our programs and services to the extent possible. So the staff have been really surprisingly great to work with, and just so committed to Baltimore City and just so committed to the work. I really didn't know what I was getting into, frankly, when I started. But I've been really pleased at the support of our board chair, who's Lena at the health department, and also the staff working so closely together. But the biggest learning curve for me was just understanding the behavioral health system, because we only, we oversee a system of care for those who are uninsurable or those who are Medicaid eligible. There's still a very large system, the hospitals and private practitioners were. So it's just a very, very large, cumbersome, not well integrated system. And I'm still learning all of that.
I know that Dr. Nguyen talked to me about balancing short and long-term goals for the health department, and how every day it's almost like you have to slap a Band-Aid on something quickly, but also be, largely working toward goals of improving the city.
Yep.
What is that balance like for you?
Yeah, I would say that that's pretty accurate at BHSB as well. But we are working on some long-term strategies with our board. So we're going to have a full-fledged strategic plan that we are going to start executing in January. It's going to our board in the end of January. So it's taken us, maybe 6 months or so to work on some long-term, short-term, long-term goals. But, there are issues that come up and day-to-day. So, if you think you're going to go in the office and, work on a plan for what you're doing 2 or 3 years from now, forget it. You're always going to have some crisis that you have to work on. So I would say my experience is maybe not as, severe as hers, because she's dealing with lots of things outside of, drug treatment, animal control and food and all that. But I would say that there's always something that comes up that you didn't plan on.
In this job, what is your definition of success?
It's funny, because I was just telling a friend, I feel like if I were here 10 years, I would just be scratching the surface, because the issues are so pervasive. They're so significant. But I would say success is really, for me and in the city and for our organization, I think would be really effectively raising awareness of what mental illness and substance use, what it is, and reducing the stigma. But we're going to have access to a lot of good data coming up here. So we're going to be able to more closely monitor the success of people who engage in drug treatment and who actually continue with drug treatment and are successful. We don't have access now, but we do have access now, but it's relatively new data. So we're going to follow that very, very closely for a long time. I think if we see more people accessing drug treatment and staying in drug treatment for a longer period of time, and being able to follow up with them and see where they are after drug treatment has ended and they're doing well, I think that will be a great marker of our success.
Kathy, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Kathy Westcoat, president of Behavioral Health System Baltimore. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast that spotlights interesting and accomplished women in the area. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or anywhere you listen to podcasts, and we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a rating on iTunes. Female Trouble is on Twitter at FMLTrouble, and you can find more online at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll be back next Tuesday. Keep